Hello, this is Bob Kruger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Thought for Food. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And Thought for Food for January 2001. What is there about the beginning of a new year that causes us to think of making changes in the way we do certain things? I'm not certain why this is, but this thinking is what leads us to make New Year's resolutions and possibly making a mental inventory of where we are and what we might like to do during the next calendar year. And during 2011, we will try to keep you up to date with the latest trends in food and health issues and hopefully make some positive suggestions on those subjects. We live in a fast-moving world and is often difficult for those of us who would prefer to move at a slower pace. So let's see how we do. A wide-sweeping food safety bill that passed the Senate in early December includes the fingerprints of both of our U.S. senators. Senator Kay Hagan, a Greensboro Democrat, helped wrestle a significant amendment meant to protect small farms and food producers from federal oversight. And Senator Richard Burr, a Winston-Salem Republican, was an original co-sponsor of the bill. He co-sponsored an amendment that required the FDA to consider education outreach to help farmers comply with the law. Hagan spent several weeks working on negotiations for the so-called Tester-Hagan Amendment pushed by her and Senator John Tester, a Montana Democrat. This amendment exempts small farms and food processing facilities with less than $500,000 in annual sales from federal oversight. Also exempted were those farms and facilities that sell to consumers within a 275-mile radius of their facilities. The small businesses would still be subject to state and local regulations, and a foodborne outbreak traced to a small farm would remove the exemption and bring in federal oversight. It's these small farmers who produce homegrown, locally grown, primarily produce, she said. Most times it's a husband and wife farming. Some farms would have had to spend $25,000 to write a hazard preparation plan, enough to put them out of business, she said. Urban Leinberger, who grows blackberries and grapes in King Mountain, about 30 miles west of Charlotte, has long been interested in seeing better farm safety rules. I think this is going to help us quite a bit, he said, who hosted Hagan on his farm in June. The food safety bill is a more sweeping set of regulations than we've been working with. In a statement released after the passage of the bill, Senator Burr said, I voted in favor of Senate Bill 510 today because I believe it's important that we modernize and update our approach to food safety to address issues that stem from our increasingly global food supply. After months of discussion and debate, I'm confident that the final version of this bill will work for North Carolina and will protect small producers and farms. Last year, we told you of the fire that destroyed the longtime Johnston County restaurant, Holt Lake Barbecue and Seafood. In the months since the fire, a sign out in front had promised, be back soon. And on December the 8th, owner Terry Barefoot made good on the pledge. The new building looks much like the one that burned in April, and the menu will be the same with a few additions. The new Holt Lake is an updated version of its 30-year-old predecessor with brand new tables and equipment. Also, wood panel walls have given way to drywall. We're just more modern, Barefoot said. The old restaurant was reduced to a concrete pad over the summer, but the layout of the L-shaped dining room hasn't changed. The cash register and drive-through window are in the same spots, and parts of the restaurant can still be closed off for meetings and special events. We didn't change any of the inside of the dining room, Barefoot said. Regulars can expect the same menu items with the usual choice of pork or beef barbecue and an array of seafood. But with a larger kitchen, Holt Lake now has room to accommodate those who would rather have their seafood broiled or grilled instead of fried. You had more people that are health conscious than they were in the past, Mr. Barefoot said. The veteran staff of about 30 people will be back as well, only a few having moved away since April. The restaurant's insurance covered their lost wages over the past several months. With the same folks waiting tables, customers can continue to expect a pitcher of sweet tea on every table and a complimentary dessert dished out before the meal. Barefoot says he's still tussling with his insurance company to cover the full loss, but was determined to open in time for the holidays. He had hoped to have reopened at least a couple months earlier. But it's good to hear that an old eating place is back in business. Congratulations. It turns out that the family may be an essential ingredient for a family-owned restaurant, especially one that's been a part of Raleigh landscape for almost a half a century, and that's what the folks at Amedeo's are thinking anyway. Founded in 1963 by Dick DeAngelis, the Italian restaurant soon became a local favorite, especially with NC State sports fans. But in later years, the restaurant on Western Boulevard ran into financial difficulties, and in January 2008, the company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, but was able to keep the door open. 10 months ago, it was purchased by the first non-family members in its 47-year history. The new owners are David Harris and Rodney Bird, experienced restaurateurs who started the Remington Grill chain. They received praise for their extensive physical renovation of the restaurant, but people missed the family touch. So after a long hiatus, Dick DeAngelis' son, Rick, became a partner in the restaurant where he grew up. And his dad, he said, is still involved, but not in day-to-day operations. Rick DeAngelis previously opened his own restaurant, Amedeo's North, and has always stated that the two restaurants were separate. Amedeo's North is being run by other family members for now. We kind of came to an agreement that we kind of need to work together as a team, he said. So I've got a partnership with these guys. My main focus right now is getting this place back to where it was. The old menu is back. The blue cheese dressing is back. We wish them well. It appears that we're not ready to always accept some changes. Among the various plans that may reach completion this year is a long-awaited and long-delayed Chick-fil-A restaurant in Cameron Village in Raleigh may finally be poised to become a reality. It's been nearly 3 years since the Atlanta-based fast food chain confirmed plans to open the nation's first two-floor Chick-fil-A in Raleigh Shopping Center. But the original plans to put the restaurant in the former Village Eye Care building on Cameron Street was scrapped after it was decided that space was too small. Officials from Chick-fil-A and Cameron Village Property Management Company Regency Centers then switched to Plan B, opting to put the restaurant on Woodburn Road in Cameron Street, basically at the corner of the existing Rite Aid store parking lot. The lease for the land has finally been executed, and Regency's Senior Vice President of Operations, John Farr, said in late December that means that Chick-fil-A can move ahead with the city's site planning approval process. Among other things hovering on the horizon will be nutrition labels on many cuts of meat in the meat counters in American supermarkets. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced this new rule will go into effect January the 1st, 2012. It will require that 40 of the most common cuts of poultry, pork, beef, and lamb include labels that disclose to consumers the total number of calories, the number of calories from fat, and the total grams of fat and saturated fat. The labels must also include details about protein, cholesterol, sodium, and vitamins, according to federal officials. The rule will apply to the whole cuts of meat and poultry, including boneless chicken breast, tenderloin steak, and ground or chopped beef such as hamburger or turkey, said officials from USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service. The nutrition labels will either need to be attached to the package itself or be available to shoppers at retail stores and grocers. The USDA official said that the new rule is designed to help American consumers be better informed about health benefits and drawbacks of the meat they buy. All this comes as consumer advocates and lawmakers alike railed against the obesity problem among American children, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have reported that American men consume 7% more calories and women 18% more than did in 1991. These nutrition fact labels were revised in the early 1990s to give consumers uniform information about serving sizes and nutrients, and became mandatory on virtually all processed food by 1994. But meat was, except under a voluntary measure, left out of the labeling overhaul. Now, as the FSIS published the rule in the Federal Register, federal officials say they're taking the first step to making such labels mandatory for meat. More and more busy American families want nutrition information they can quickly and easily understand, Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack said in a statement. We need to do all we can to provide nutrition labels that will help consumers make informed decisions. You might be surprised at what you find. According to the USDA's Nutrient Data Laboratory, a 4-ounce serving of ground beef that is 80% lean meat contains 280 calories, with 200 of those calories coming from 23 grams of fat. Some local chains are already posting the information, anticipating the new rules. Proponents see this labeling as a weapon against obesity, as customers armed with calorie information make choices when they're at the restaurant table or standing at a cash register. Americans get 1/3 of their calories from food prepared outside of the home, according to the Food and Drug Administration. With an increasing number of cities, counties, and states requiring caloric information on menus, the National Restaurant Association endorsed a national law as a way to set a single standard. North Carolina does not have its own law. The labeling increases costs and hassles for restaurant owners, association spokesman Michael Donahue said. It's too soon to put a price on the changes, he said, but Congress took cost into account when it decided the requirements should apply only to chains with more than 20 locations. Just as companies decided to change their recipes when the FDA required trans fat labels, calorie labels could spur restaurants to change the way they prepare food to lower calorie counts, said Alice Ammerman, a professor in the nutrition department of UNC Chapel Hill's Gilling School of Global Public Health. But it's not clear whether the labels change what people eat. Other cities and states have had menu labeling for a few years, and early studies conflict on whether it influences customers' choices. A study by New York University and Yale University of fast food restaurants in low-income New York neighborhoods with high rates of obesity concluded that the information didn't change what customers preferred, while a later study by the city's health department said it did, with 56% of the customers noticing the labels. Panera Bread started putting calorie counts on its menu this year, 2010, and the company didn't see any changes in customer preferences when the menu displays were tested in other markets, said John Franzetta, who is the marketing director for Brendwitter's at the Triangle, which has 11 Panera Bread restaurants in the Triangle. Sales didn't drop off, Francetta said. The menu didn't change. Only one of the 8 customers leaving Panera Bread on Six Forks saw the labels. The remodeled Golden Corral on Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh, the chain's new prototype restaurant, prints calorie information in small type at the bottom of cards identifying the buffet choices, along with information on serving size, fat, protein, and carbohydrates. On a recent weekday, the nutrition information escaped the notice of 8 Golden Corral customers and even one employee. Chris Kuhn, Golden Corral's marketing chief, said since labeling was coming, the company wanted to try it out in its prototype. They'll wait until the federal regulations are final before they add nutrition information in restaurants where it isn't mandated, he said. Margot Wooten, who was director of nutrition policy at the Center for Science and the Public Interest in Washington, D.C., said more people will notice the labels when the nationwide requirement kicks in. Labeling doesn't stop people from eating out, Wooten said, but it lets them know, for example, whether a roast beef sandwich has fewer calories than a tuna sandwich. The majority of Americans are interested in nutrition and want to eat better, she said. I wonder if that statement's true. It seems that during the recession, we're eating more cereals. Case in point, cereal manufacturer Malt-O-Meal announced plans to hire 80 new workers and invest $135 million at its manufacturing plant in Asheboro. That's in Randolph County. Malt-O-Meal already employs 200 people in Asheboro. It opened its 350,000-square-foot plant last year. Based in Minnesota, Malt-O-Meal makes inexpensive hot and cold cereals and produces 10 of the 50 best-selling brands. The company is enjoying a growing demand for its cereals and gaining market share, even as overall cereal market is shrinking, spokesman John Austin said. Last year's introduction of its Better Oats lineup of instant oatmeal, which is produced in the Asheboro plant, was one of the company's most successful new product launches ever. Austin credits the company's success to products that taste good and offer a better value than the competition. The family-owned company doesn't disclose revenue figures, employs more than 1,700 workers nationwide. Other products made in Asheboro include Frosted Mini Spooners and Frosted Flakes. The army still marches on its stomach. Napoleon coined the phrase, but it's true today as ever. Good food is essential to good results in war. And out at Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri, army leaders are taking this aphorism to a higher level. Basic training now includes instruction in health, fitness, and diet. And the food in mess halls there is heavy on fresh fruit and whole grains and light on junk food. Military recruits, of course, mirror civilian society, where lousy diet and obesity is a growing problem. Lieutenant General Mark Hertling of the Army Training and Doctrine Command sees a need to create the soldier athlete. To do that, he said, we've changed from feeding soldiers to fueling the tactical athlete. And the general is a role model in that he competes in triathlons. At posts where the Army has implemented the new diet and exercise programs, leaders are seeing fewer injuries and higher scores on fitness tests. Do we suppose our schools might want to look into this? And maybe civilian adults, too? Good questions. This might sound a bit strange. People with suspected food allergies may need to submit to an oral food challenge, ingesting the food in a doctor's office while symptoms are assessed in order to receive an accurate diagnosis, according to a consortium of food allergy experts led by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The guidelines specifically rule out attempting to diagnose a food allergy solely by skin pricks or blood tests that merely suggest an individual is sensitized to a particular food. Those tests, however, may be combined with a medical history and exam, and if needed, an oral food challenge to arrive at a diagnosis. Adherence to the recommendations should help people discover whether they are truly allergic to certain foods, said Dr. Hugo A. Sampson, a professor of pediatrics at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York and past president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. A lot of physicians order large numbers of blood tests of various foods, and when they find small amounts of antibody present, they indicate to the patient that they're allergic to this food and should need it, he said. Many patients are placed on highly restrictive diets that are probably not necessary. I'm one of those fortunate people who is allergic to no food. Of course, I like some items better than others. The humble sweet potato, a staple in Southern cuisine and perennial favorite on Thanksgiving dinner tables, is looking a lot more cosmopolitan. With U.S. consumption growing slowly, farmers have found a market for the vitamin-packed, cholesterol-free sweet potato on the tables of health-conscious Europeans. Between 2005 and 2009, the value of U.S. sweet potato exports more than doubled to $51.4 million, with much of that growth coming from Europe, especially Great Britain. The value of exports to the United Kingdom jumped $5.7 million to $20.4 million between 2005 and 2009. And in the first 6 months of 2010, exports were on a pace to comfortably exceed last year's totals, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Even Ireland, famous for its white potatoes, is getting a taste of the orange kind. Ireland imported $125,000 worth of sweet potatoes last year, but that's up from none in 2005. It's a huge change from even 10 years ago when European supermarkets branded the sweet potato an exotic vegetable and relegated it to a few feet of out-of-the-way shelves in the produce department. The growth has been so swift that it's hard to isolate a single reason for it. It's a great-tasting vegetable, first of all, said Jerome Vick, co-owner of Vick Family Farms in Wilson, North Carolina. Vick has been growing sweet potatoes since 1982, and in the past 5 years has seen Europe become an increasingly important market. Along with the 40-pound boxes of potatoes he packs for the American market, he sells potatoes in the European standard 6 kilograms, about 13-pound packs. Vick also follows the food safety standards adopted by European supermarket chains. They're a little more stringent in terms of food safety, and since we're always been food safety oriented on this farm, it's a good fit, he said. American farmers are also investing in new equipment to help ensure uniform size and shape in the potatoes, says David Picka, a professor at Louisiana State University Agriculture Center. Americans have an advantage over rival farmers in countries like Israel, Egypt, and South Africa, Picka said. We can provide a constant high-quality sweet potatoes on a year-round basis, and that's something very few countries can do, he said. But the biggest boost may have come from farmers' recent promotions, which helped inform European consumers about the sweet potato, he said. 10 years ago, this was an undiscovered vegetable in Europe. We've done a great job of promoting it and building awareness of the flavor and nutritional value since then. The North Carolina Sweet Potato Commission, for example, has been holding promotions with European supermarkets in the past few years, with the largest one in Sweden. North Carolina, which grows about 47% of U.S. sweet potatoes, is one of the major American producers, along with Louisiana, Mississippi, and California. They're still grown here and still popular here, but now we're seeing them popular with people all over, said Sue Johnson, the executive director of the North Carolina Commission. In U.S., value-added products like sweet potato fries are helping put more sweet potatoes on more plates, but not at a rate comparable with Britain. In the U.S., value-added products like sweet potato fries are helping put more sweet potatoes on more plates, but not at a rate comparable like Britain. Per capita American consumption slumped between the mid-1980s and 2003 when it began inching upward. It's now just over 5 pounds a person, and I feel like I'm eating a part of someone else's share. With all the marketing, new standards, and new equipment help, but for farmers like Vick, the vegetable speaks for itself. Sweet potatoes have always been a popular vegetable in the South, but people in the North have always eaten a lot of them too, he said. I guess it just took a little while for the news to make it across the ocean. Mr. Vick seems to be a very progressive farmer. When customers walk into Common Sense Grocers, it looks like a typical small grocery store until they notice the prices. During late December, the shelves held Ken's salad dressing for 10 cents a bottle. A 16-pound bag of Pettigrew puppy dog food was $9.95, and boxes of Rice Krispies, $1.50. Common Sense Grocers, located near the corner of Millbrook Road and Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh, is what is known in the grocery business as a banana box store and offers name-brand groceries to consumers at around 50% off the retail price. When stores pull products off the shelf because they're discontinued or damaged, they put them into banana boxes to sell to wholesalers. And grocery stores such as Common Sense Groceries then buy the product from the wholesaler at a fraction of the price and are able to pass the savings on to their customers. The store opened in March and is a partnership between Ronald Antini, Neil Farrand, Bruce Berwick, and Charlene Dark, a group of friends who all attend Evergreen Church. And when the church lost a long-standing tenant in the building it owned, the group decided to open a business in the spot and settled on a banana box store because there's not a store like it in the Raleigh area. Starting Common Sense Grocers wasn't just about making money for it, Farron says. It was about helping the community by providing a low-cost grocery option and helping the church by renting their building. Although the store has a few dented items, it mainly sells items that are in good condition, and all of the products on the shelves are name brands and guaranteed to be fresh. When you're counting pennies, it's an extra punch in the gut to have to buy food in dented cans. It gives our customers a lift to be able to take home nice-looking products, said store manager Lynette Stone. The store has a sizable organic food section, including baby food, and recently introduced an international food section. as a convenience to customers, Common Sense Grocers always stocks milk, eggs, and cheese and sells them at cost. In November, the store began accepting EBT, electronic benefit transfers, also referred to as food stamps. Because store purchases large pallets of items in banana boxes from the wholesaler, they can't order specific products in their shipments, which comes in about once a month. When a new order comes in, it's like Christmas to us because we don't know what products we're going to be getting, Farron says. The store sends out an email newsletter when new products are stocked. The staff at Common Sense puts an emphasis on customer service. Staffers help customers carry groceries out to their car and will match the price of any item priced lower at another store. If a customer is not happy with the quality of an item, Stone says they can simply tell her about it in their next visit and do not even have to bring the product back to get a credit. Stone and other employees also take time to get to know their customers. I know whose spouse had just passed away, who had a new baby, and whose son is seriously ill, she said. In addition to being one of the owners of the store, Farron, the father of four boys, is also a customer. My wife and I love shopping at the store, he said. The pricing helps our family, and the variety of products gets the kids to try things we might not typically have bought. I'm going to check the store out, and I'll tell you of my impressions. An amateur computer game designer in Raleigh claimed a $50,000 cash prize in an Xbox contest to promote Doritos chips and snack foods. Joe Robertson's Doritos Crash Course game, designed for the Xbox 350, was selected by her fellow gamers nationwide as the winner in a contest run by Doritos. As a part of her victory, she will also have an opportunity to consult with Doritos on gaming for 6 months. Robinson, 28, works as a copy center associate at Staples and said the cash will pay for coursework at Wake Tech Community College in programming or a related field. I knew I had it in me, she said in an interview. I don't want to work in retail for the rest of my life. The voting came down to Robertson's obstacle course game versus a race game designed by Justin Carpenter in Utah. The two finalists triumphed over 1,500 ideas submitted in the fall of 2009, and Doritos also awarded Carpenter $50,000. But unlike Robinson, some of the contestants worked full-time in video design. Using self-taught computer graphic skills, Robertson spent several days making a 2-minute video to pick her Xbox concept. The game itself was designed by Microsoft teams in Chile and Canada, she said. She and her husband are avid video gaming fans. Both work at Staples. Mrs. Robertson, a native of Iowa, moved to the Triangle with her family at the age 9. Doritos has been enlisting its fans in contests since 2007 when the company gave consumers an opportunity to make commercials to run during the Super Bowl. Congratulations, Jill. One thing we might consider for the coming year is to waste less food. It's estimated about one-third of the food we buy is wasted. No, we don't deliberately set out to throw good food away. Too often we don't utilize our leftovers. For all too many, the term leftover is a turnoff, but we could all use it more wisely. Don't leave them in the refrigerator until they're no longer edible. Or if you have packaged an item and placed it in your freezer, don't forget it. We've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food, and be sure to listen this time next month.